From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Law professor Joan Williams declares that the United States presently has the most hostile to family public policy in the developed world. And she ties some of the major obstacles to overcoming that troubling characterization not only to politics and gender roles, but also to class. We talk with her next hour about her latest book, Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. Next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. Joan Williams is Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law. She's also the author of Unbending Gender, Why Family and Work Conflict and What to Do About It. And recently, Harvard University Press published her new book, Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. And she joins us in studio for this forum hour. And good to have you back here on forum. Welcome.
Delighted to be here.
Well, I guess one of the real eye-catching things that you see in your book is that the United States, and this is not going to come as a great surprise to many people, is presently the most hostile to family public policy in the developed world of all the developed world nations. And in fact, dramatically so. Isn't that the case?
Dramatically so. We have no paid leave, no subsidized child care. Very few workers' rights that they have in Europe, such as limits on mandatory overtime, the right to request flexibility, the right to request part-time. The list goes on and on and on. It's really quite extraordinary.
Family leave particularly comes to the fore in your new book. And when we think about family leave now in light of the fact that, as you report, all these new health reports telling us that breastfeeding should be done for 12 months, that it's important as much for fathers to spend time with their new babies and children as it is for mothers, almost as important, up in the 90 percentile for both. But also, we're talking about protecting families, really, protecting them from getting thrown out on the street and losing their mortgages. In many cases, somebody missed a day of work and they're gone.
I actually, right now, I'm writing a report on the impact of work-family conflict on low-income families, and I was just talking to an advocate a couple of weeks ago, and she was describing a young woman who came off welfare, got a job, missed one day of work because her baby was sick, and was homeless very quickly after that.
And in many instances, as you point out, the poor are maybe more taken care of than the working class or the lower middle class when it comes to these kinds of needs.
Well, it's complicated. In the United States, no one's really taken care of. I mean, one of the things that's really striking about work-family conflict and why it has such explosive political potential is that you have very affluent professional women with extraordinarily acute work-family conflict all the way down to very low-income women who are, you know, losing their kids and becoming homeless because of work-family conflict.
But so often the studies are on the professional class of white women, the managerial class.
Absolutely. And one of the things that the Center for Work-Life Law at Hastings, which I run, has really – I'm very proud of, is that we started very early to study the impact of work-family conflict on less privileged families.
And it's not only the children we're talking about that present this kind of conflict in terms of family leave and in terms of just being protected with jobs. It's also taking care of the elderly in so many instances.
Absolutely. One in four American families are taking care of an elderly family member. And, you know, it's not only the elderly as well. It's the sick, because now people – healthcare has improved so much that many people – are alive who would not have been alive a generation ago. And we have hospitals let them out quicker and sicker. And who do they think is going to take care of these people?
You talk in your book about building bridges, and you talk about the importance of politics and the necessity of politics. President Obama felt that he just built a bridge with the Republicans by allowing these tax cuts to stay in place at the same time that those on unemployment would at least get unemployment for an extension. But you talk about the necessity to reshape American politics, and I wanted to find out how this could be done. I mean, where the political will and where the teeth is for such things as subsidizing child care or nationally financing parental leave. I mean, everybody agrees that we're way behind. Where's the political will going to come from? Where's the populist outrage going to come from?
I'm glad you asked that, because part of the motivation behind this book is that there is a lot of sort of happy talk of like, well, we should do this, we should do that, we should do the other. And, you know, it's science fiction. We're not going to do any of this. This requires social subsidies, and it requires workers' rights. And the American politics is not in a mood right now for either. And so
also probably requires more taxes.
Well, that's a less polite term for social subsidies, Michael.
Yeah, we're talking about revenue enhancement in the last hour. There's all kinds of metaphors and euphemisms. But we are, you know, from the Republican standpoint, they call it taxes.
They call it taxes. And so the question is how you create the political will to shift American politics that has veered so far to the right. And the answer I give in this book is that American politics has been driven further and further to the right, really since 1970, by unrecognized class conflict. That what has fueled the resurgence of conservatism in the United States is conservatives' ability to connect in a deep way with the white working class. And that's something that progressives have to begin to think a lot more deeply about.
And maybe not just think in terms of science fiction, but think about action that will be resolute and will move in that area?
You know, wishful thinking is not going to get us there. I think, you know, in many ways, I think it starts with Homer Simpson. If you think about the difference between Terry Malloy and On the Waterfront, you know, I could have been a contender. That movie invites us to empathize and connect with the frustration of a white working class man. The images we see in our popular culture today of white working class men are like Homer Simpson, overweight, borderline alcoholic, laughable. And in many ways, Homer Simpson is a deconstruction of masculinity, but it's a very safe one because it's a deconstruction of blue-collar masculinity. It doesn't touch privileged masculinity. And it's an example of how these open class affronts are very much accepted in polite progressive society. A lot of the book's analysis of class rests on my reading of the memoirs of people I call class migrants, people who were born working class who now have become professionals. And they have sat in classrooms where people referred to them as white trash. And the kinds of class we now have a taboo on racial affronts. We sorely need a similar taboo on class affronts. And that's not very far, but it is the first important step.
Well, it's still America's dirty little secret, as it's so often called. That is the class differences. We're talking to Joan C. Williams, who's Distinguished Professor of Law and Founding Director of the Center for Work-Life Law at UC Hastings College of the Law. Her book is Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. And now we're talking about this dirty little secret, but let's talk about also why men matter, because so often the whole division of labor comes down to freeing up women more and so forth. And as you point out in your book, women will, in many instances, feel they have to be nurtured and they have to take the role of the mother, and so they'll give up a career for maybe a year or two with the idea that they're going to go back and find it in so many instances almost impossible to go back.
Yes, it's really profoundly sobering that the one study shows that a woman who takes this is a professional woman who takes 1 year off a career loses 20% of her lifetime earnings, and a woman who takes two or three loses 30% of her lifetime earnings. This is completely artificial. This has nothing to do with the rate of deterioration of her human capital. This is social stigma and specifically gender bias.
Now, so women are still doing three times as much childcare. Maybe that's part of the problem, but I think we get into a deeper area with you, the workplace and what the workplace expects out of men and what they expect out of themselves because of masculine roles. If you're going to have a real division of men and women in terms of childcare, you're not only going to have different laws in place and different subsidies, as you put it, childcare and parental leave and all of that. But you're going to have, I think your argument is, and I want to get you to be specific about this, is that men have to stop seeing themselves as breadwinners almost, as, you know, more hours that I'm going to work because I have to play the role of the male.
It's complicated. The classic answer is, well, women do three times as much childcare and they want to. And so, of course, women are going to opt out. And that's just sort of the natural history of the world. I think we have to stop looking exclusively at the women and start looking, as you point out, at the men. What kind of gender pressures are men under these days in these, you know, and here in this new millennium? If a man is if your mom says she wants you to marry a successful man, is she talking about one with a snuggly or one with a fat paycheck? What the studies show is that a man who takes even a short time off for a family reason, a half a day, is recommended for lower raises and has lower performance evaluations. And if you look at what people say to men who actually make caregiving responsibilities salient, obvious on the job, they're called wimps, they're called wusses. There is a lot of very direct gender affronts, very direct gender policing, which, by the way, is illegal, clearly illegal. A lot of
and often more in the working class.
Actually, throughout.
Pervasive, but more in the working class?
No, absolutely. Pervasive throughout. That men who make caregiving responsibilities salient on the job often get derided. And one of the things you see in studying, I'm not sure this is a class difference either. The study of union arbitrations, which the Center for Work-Life Law has now studied for 6 or 7 years, one of the patterns that we see is a lot of these guys do have family responsibilities because the families are tag teaming, where mom is working one shift and dad is working another shift. And so if either parent is ordered to stay mandatory overtime, they have to choose between mom's job and dad's job, and they need both to pay the mortgage. So the dads leave, but one of the things that you see is when the dads leave, they don't tell anybody why they're leaving. I call it caring in secret. And so they're much more likely to be fired for job abandonment or insubordination because they're, I think, too embarrassed to admit that they have caregiving responsibilities. And I have to say that's not unlike professional managerial men. We work a lot at the Center for Work-Life Law with law firms through the Project for Attorney Retention. And men who even ask about part-time, some firms are fabulous, and that's great. And some firms actually now have half of the people who are lawyers who are working part-time are men. But in many others, just asking for part-time is the kiss of death.
It means you're not as committed to your job somehow in terms of those who have already children growing up or who don't have children at all. You're not as passionate because you're putting your domestic life, so to speak, ahead of your work.
And you know the other thing, Michael, is it means you're less of a man to some people. Who's wearing the pants in this household that you have to come to me and say, I need time off. The other thing is that if you look at the imagery of fatherhood in the United States, there's a wonderful book called The Package Deal. And being a good provider is literally a core part of being a good father. So a man who becomes a stay-at-home father, who takes time off work to care for his kids, in many people's minds, he is less good, not only less effective a man, he is less good a father. Now, that is acute gender pressure on men to keep doing exactly what they've already always done. And that really, I've said for 10 years, work-family conflict really is all about men, not about women.
But the new feminism was supposed to have turned a lot of these corners, and the number of men was supposedly burgeoning all over who were not, you know, women who were very successful in careers, stay-at-home dads, Mr. Dad and all that, so Mr. Mom, whatever. It hasn't really taken as hold, I'm inferring from what you have argued here and the research that you've done, as many people assume it has. Maybe we're in a cocoon in Northern California too?
We are in a cocoon. I like the cocoon, but in cocoon it is. The last time I looked, the number of stay-at-home fathers had doubled from 2 to 4%. 25% of American mothers aged 25 to 44 is out of the labor force, and that just shows you where we are. Now, it's not that nothing has changed. There is an important change among some younger men who say, this is my ideal of fatherhood. It is to be involved with my children day to day, and I'm going to do what women have long done. I'm going to become a consultant where I can pursue a career without having it be a straitjacket. But that's very definitely a minority. It's an important minority, but it's a very small minority.
And we're talking to Joan Williams. Her new book is Reshaping the Work Family Debate, and she'd like to start a national conversation about gender pressures on men. In fact, you say at one point in your book, you need both sexes to challenge the definitions of masculinity to keep men anxiously at work.
That's right. That's right. And I think that, there's a lot of different ways to be a man. And we see that. I even actually think a lot of Brad Pitt. You think of some of the messages that Brad Pitt sends. I mean, he has the big muscles and the little babies. And he is very much playing around with both and sending a message that being a sexy, strong man is consistent with being a nurturing father. I think I look at the stuff like that. I notice things like that.
Well, you also notice things like the fact that state disability insurance finances certain kinds of things that would make it even more sensible to move along a trajectory you're talking about here. Talk about that.
Cue me that again?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I follow you, Michael.
No, I was reading an article that you did about state disability insurance, and you said here's the revenue that comes from state disability insurance that ought to be used more towards something like family leave.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's Heather Boucher of the Center for American Progress is really at the center of that. And what she points out is that we think it's impossible to have paid family leave. But if you could use state disability insurance funds to finance paid family leave, that is a very viable option that would not be attacked as an too expensive social subsidy.
Another person you cite in your book and in articles I've read that you've done is Lisa Belkin, who gave women this sort of opt-out narrative. I mean, that's really what it is. It's a narrative that says, if you have a child, you opt out of the job you're doing for, like I say, a year or two or maybe completely. Right. And does that narrative have to be changed?
That opt-out narrative has to be changed. Lisa didn't invent it, but she certainly rechristened it. It used to be called the choice argument. And then she wrote this very famous article, I think it was 2003, called The Opt-Out Revolution. And, I have to hand it both to Lisa and to the New York Times. In response to a lot of criticism and the report that I wrote called Opt Out or Pushed Out, The Real Story of Women in Work, the New York Times has changed its narrative. I was really struck earlier this year, by an article by David Leonard, which was talking about Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan and pointing out that both of them don't have children. And it was not headed, gee, this is what you have to do in order to be a success. It was headed, is the labor market hostile to mothers? And, I said, boy, hats off New York Times.
Just clarity on the opt-out, though. It's not necessarily for women who opt out not to have children. It's more the idea that if you have a child, you maybe ought to sacrifice your career for that child.
That's true. But what the New York Times was pointing out in this article, and David Leonard, no less, on the first page of the business section, was that in order to be successful at the highest levels in the United States today, still the only alternative for many women is to not have children. Because if they do have children, the labor market is so hostile to mothers that the only thing they can do is, quote, opt out, unquote, of their careers.
So let's talk about what you mean by reconstructive feminism.
Reconstructive feminism is actually a term that I coined in Unbending Gender 10 years ago. And it's designed to send the message that we have to focus really on certain masculine norms. These are masculine norms of the ideal worker, that someone who is a really committed worker starts to work in early adulthood and works full-time, full force for 40 years straight, taking no time off for child rearing, or really anything else. That masculine norm is precisely the problem that fathers who want to take parental leave time, that fathers who want to restrict their hours in order to care for their children, that's the masculine norm that hurts them. That masculine norm also hurts women in many ways because you know what? That masculine norm designs workplaces around basically a breadwinner married to a homemaker. And most women can't go there, and even fewer want to go there, because it requires women to behave in ways that are traditional for a man, but not a woman. And many women, myself included, really cherish the roles and the traditions of femininity. And so what you have to do, I think, in order to have any realistic vision of gender equality is to look deeply at these masculine norms and say, you know what? They don't fit women, and they don't fit where most men want to go either. And that's not to say that men shouldn't be men. I mean, vive la différence. We all get a big kick out of it at some level. But it shouldn't be tied to these ways of being, and men shouldn't be straitjacketed into these very old-fashioned norms that are out of sync with today's economy and out of sync with today's ideals.
There are a lot of what Blake would have called mind-forged manacles here, though, that have to be...
mind-forged manacles. I'll remember that.
Well, it's a good phrase for... I mean, you have this sense of masculinity, as you're pointing out, and it stays in the mind from the earliest part of development. I honestly thought that, I mean, I remember writing an article many years ago. I was walking with my then 3-year-old daughter on my back, and it was during the day because I was teaching school, and suddenly realizing there are a lot of people here who were maybe looking at me because it was odd. We're talking about early 80s, you know. It doesn't seem odd anymore. It really doesn't. Whatever the case may be, it seems almost ubiquitous.
I get such a kick out of that. I mean, I go... I walk in the middle of the day and you see lots of guys wearing their babies. And, you know, the thing that I think is important is they don't see themselves as any less manly. This has now become one way of being manly. So the idea is not to attack men or to attack masculinity, but really to reshape it in ways that are healthier for families and, frankly, healthier for men.
Maybe the whole ideal of some of the early feminists, and I'm thinking particularly, second wave of feminism, not Betty Friedan or Simone de Beauvoir, but later on with Kate Millett and Gloria Steinem, it seemed to be, in many women's minds, the idea that they had to choose one or the other. They had to choose, again, that narrative between I'm either going to go full bore to the career or I'm going to go full bore to motherhood. And it's so difficult for many women to find both. And they need the male support if they're going to find both.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons why when people say, oh, well, you know, you can't have it all, my response is, well, you know, women are actually only asking to have what men have always had, which is a satisfying intimate life and a satisfying work life, what Freud said we all need.
So I have a cousin who says, who claims that when it comes down to it, if there's an emergency or, you know, the childcare person is in an emergency situation, it's almost always the mother. And she's probably right.
I think that's changing a little bit. I think it's also still true. I think it's partly because women are judged, and therefore women judge themselves on that, whereas men are much less likely to be judged and to judge themselves. But that's another way that the class dimension comes in. And I hear that we don't have a lot of time, so maybe I can pick that up after a break.
Okay, and also you emphasize, of course, what has to be done at the workplace. The attitudes have to change there, above all.
Absolutely.
I mean, at home as well as in the workplace, above all. We're talking to Joan Williams again. Her book is Reshaping the Work-Family Debate. You may want to get into this conversation, debate, and in fact, we welcome your phone calls. You can join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius Satellite. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. And we welcome your calls. Again, that's 866-733-6786, or send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Hastings Law Professor Joan Williams, who says the United States has the most family-hostile public policy in the developed world. Her new book is Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. And she says that the United States needs to implement long-talked-about flexibility in the workplace and argues in her book that the needs of men, who now, by the way, report higher levels of work-family conflict than women, have to be part of the discussions. And we're going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here, but we want to pick up on the that last point where I mentioned my cousin and her point that it's almost always the mothers who are called in when there's an emergency. You were saying...
Well, there's a famous story where Ruth Bader Ginsburg was constantly called, and finally she said to the school, you know, this child has two parents. I do think it's often the mothers, but one of the things I think that is really important to point out is that in terms of the relating across class about these issues, if you look at the out viewpoint, the mentality, if you will, of the working class, and this is true regardless of race, it's really a family comes first mentality. So that I think most of us would agree that if a child is sick, you leave. Someone has to go take care of the child. When the working class looks at the professional managerial class, one of the things that they notice and they criticize is how the role of work in structuring our identities and our most basic commitments. And they frankly think that the professional managerial class has gotten a little out of sync in terms of its obsession with work. And that family is an incredibly important value that sometimes people whom they see as more elite than them are sadly out of touch with that.
Let's go to our callers, and we'll begin with Connie, who's joining us from Sacramento. Good morning, Connie.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yes, hi. You're on the air. We can hear you fine.
Okay. I just wanted to comment. I work in the medical field, and when my children were young, I chose to work weekends and odd shifts so that my husband could provide childcare when I was at work. A tremendous number of the women that I work with now do the same thing. They either work the odd shifts and their husband works day shift or vice versa, and the men are fully involved in childcare. So I don't know how you measure the number of people doing that, but in my hospital, they're a very large number.
In fact, it has been measured, and one out of three American families with small children handle child care through tag teaming. Mom works one shift, dad works another shift, just as you say. And one out of four American families with children handle child care that way, period. It's incredibly pervasive.
If there isn't a tag team to use, or if there aren't grandparents or whatever, neighbors, people to switch with and do bartering in terms of child care, often boils down to there used to be something called women's work, you know, and so many women who work in all fields today and who have gone into careers and professions unlike anything we had imagined, say, just a quarter of a century ago, find themselves thinking, is this economically sound for me to work part-time, let's say, at whatever my job might be with the child care costs that I have to pay?
Well, part of the reason is that women look at the childcare costs as a cost of their working rather than a cost of their husband's working. And so one of the dynamics that drives women out of the workforce is that, number one,
that's why I called it women's work in many people.
Yeah, there's huge amount of gender discrimination, and that depresses women's wages. And then both the woman and her partner see that childcare cost as a cost of the woman's working, whereas it really is a cost of protecting the future, the economic future of the entire family and specifically of the children. Because given divorce laws, if a woman very much cuts back or drops out and, God forbid, there's a divorce, very often it's the children who are who suffer economically because of that.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we go to Oakland. Lola, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have two points. My first question is, I'd love to hear some more policy recommendations and solutions, like you were mentioning the bit about the paid family leave coming from disability funds. And then, so I'd like to hear more about that. And then my second point is, how do you see this, the rise of kind of the hyper parent or helicopter parent, or kind of, you know, these really intense pressures to make your own child food and make sure they're constantly being enriched? And how do you see those elements kind of affecting this debate?
Well, I'm glad you asked about the helicopter parenting, and let me premise my comments to say that I did it. On the other hand, if you look, first of all, it's not traditional. It is not traditional parenting. I mean, I was born in 1952, and when I came home, my mother sent us outside to play. That was her. That was, she was not down on the board. She was not down on the floor with Mozart, you know, baby Mozart or flashcards or taking me to Gymboree, I have to tell you. So it's not traditional, and so you have to ask why it's happened. There's actually one study that shows that it's happened a lot less in Canada. And the study ties this incredible speed up in the American household to the sharp hierarchical structure of American universities. Now, in Canada, most people go to a public, oh, everybody goes to a public university, if I'm correct, and there's not this sharp difference between Harvard and not Harvard.
Well, there's McGill and, you know, universities that are elitist universities.
That's true, but you don't have this elaborate elite structure that you do have in the United States. And the thesis of the two people who wrote this article, the two economists, were this helicopter parent is really an expression of class anxiety in the United States. The feeling that if I don't get my I don't get my kid into Yale, that's where I went, so I'll plug Yale. My life will be over. His life will be over, and you know he'll end up being something. God forbid, something like
and you got into plumber. Yale without the Mozart or the flashcards.
I did. I have to say.
And the policy question, I mean, you talk about the right to request flexible schedule. I mean, there are a lot of policies that you get
into.
There
are so many policies. I mean, you think about it, something as easy as universal pre-K, which exists in red states like Georgia, has not taken place at the national level. After-school programs are incredibly important. In the Netherlands, you can go in and ask for fewer hours in your same jobs. Of course, there is the right to, you know, we don't have, I mean, the family leave that we have is just astonishing. It's unpaid. It's 3 months. There's just so much.
Proportional
that needs to be
pay
done.
For part-time work.
Proportional pay for part-time work, so-called part-time equity is incredibly important. Limits on mandatory overtime, neighborhood-based child care centers that are actually subsidized. I was just reading this morning a quote from a low-wage woman who said that when she picks her baby up at the child care center, when her dad picked her baby up at the child care center one time, there's vomit down the front of the child and that the diaper rash is so bad, it's as if someone had cut the child with a knife. I mean, welcome to child rearing in the United States. It's just profoundly shocking.
It is shocking. Many people, of course, hear this. They say, well, all these policies, utopia, you know, but it's done in almost every developed country in the world, most of the things you mentioned.
So you have to ask why it hasn't done in the United States, why these things are so politically impossible.
Well,
in
some would
States.
Say because we're so big and because we're so behemoth and gigantic and so forth, but they're all viable things. Let me go to more calls here. I'm editorializing. Douglas, join us. Hi.
Hi. I was born in 1957, and I really appreciate what the author is saying. I'd like to try to make 3 points. Number one, the point about manliness and a father with, you know, a baby on his back or on his belly. I have a 10-year-old son. I'm a single dad. His mom lives in Marin. I live in San Francisco. I still long and love the fact that my son will hold my hand as we walk down the street. And as I look at fathers with kids on them, I don't think of them as unmanly in any way. And I really think that educated men, regardless of culture, and enlightened men do not look at another man with a child on them or holding their hand as unmanly. And if anything, they respect that guy for having taken that effort. So I really kind of want to say that fathers should have this connection with a child. And, you know, mothers have a unique connection based upon breastfeeding and the birthing aspect that fathers don't. So to have a physical connection with your child, I think, is truly important. And it's one that I am afraid when my son is old enough, he doesn't want to hold my hand, it will be tough on me. The second thing that I'd like to say is for 16 years, I was a private consultant working with Fortune 50, Fortune 100, Fortune 500 firms. To provide what this lady is saying in a corporate environment, whether it's private or over, you know, the stock exchange, is a benefit to an organization because it will reduce turnover. It will provide greater loyalty. It will provide a better outcome with these sorts of benefits that will provide to the bottom line in a way that has not been spoken in corporate America and needs to be addressed because it's an intangible that can provide tangible results. The last thing that I'd like to say is that for me as a father, I'm really bothered by the fact, and I actually feel sensitive to this, that working women talk about the need to balance personal life and business life and, oh, poor me. There's a dismissiveness that fathers don't go through that, that we don't battle that, that we don't feel those same things that women vocalize. We just don't have a voice. We just don't have the view. We just don't have Oprah. And we don't sit there, and quite frankly, I think this is an issue with men, we don't whine about it enough. We don't bitch about it enough. We have the same feelings that women do and battle the same feelings about balancing personal life, family life, and professional life. It's very difficult. And every father I talk to when I'm traveling on the road that is not with their child and they're doing work regrets the fact that they're not with their child. And I don't think that's honored or spoken about enough. And I think that culturally we need to step up and address the fact that men have these challenges too.
You know, I'm trying to. I appreciate your comments. And one of the point of the book is to exactly to give you a voice. Men now face report more work-family conflict than women. And I honor them for that. I think that they do feel these things deeply, but I think that many men in their workplaces, it's just not practical for them to try to act on those values. And I think that corporate America and all of America needs to step up and empower men to act on those family values. Let me also say just that the businesses should be taking the lead here. I can't agree with you more that businesses should be playing an important role. In fact, one of the things I'm doing right now is writing a report about how businesses can improve the work-life fit for...
Now, how much can we blame the workplace, actually? I mean, you seem to certainly hold them out as being a great deal responsible. And do we need federal or state policies for change, or can we fault the workplace for simply doing less than they should?
I'm not sure why I would use the word blame, but I do think that that employers need to rethink today's workplace for today's workforce, and that once they do... there would be a lot more workplace flexibility for men as well as women. But I also want to speak up for business here. Many, many businesses in the United States are small businesses. And I think that financing, having small employers themselves offer paid leave to their employees simply is doing what I call socializing over too small a group. I just don't think that's practical. I do think that businesses need some support from the government in order to handle these problems effectively.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. I want to go to some emails here. Getting some... dissenting points of view. Here's Rich, who says, enough of this talk of men needing time off for childcare and giving multimillionaire Brad Pitt as an example of the modern man. The biggest problem facing modern men is the competition of women for traditionally male jobs, when at the same time men are still expected to be breadwinners.
I think that the fact that men face this pressure to be breadwinners, which is both external and internalized, has really reached a crisis point, particularly with the current recession and the fact that men have lost, well, at one point, they had lost three-fourths of the jobs. And I think that men really have a choice. They're really at a crossroads. And this is one thing that the recent Newsweek cover story said. Men can really feel terrible about themselves, that they're not able to be these traditional breadwinners, or they can say, let's invent a new idea of what it means to be a really impressive man. And I'm inviting men to take the second path.
Here's Kim, who says, the prospect of any subsidies for parental leave is infuriating. There are more than 300 million people in the United States, and the creation of any more should be discouraged rather than supported. There is already insufficient room for non-human species. Furthermore, family-based policies are automatically unfair to the single and child-free, who are typically expected to pick up the slack for a society and workplace that values the concerns of families more importantly than those of singles.
I hear that. And I think that one of the things that often happens now is because of the lack of a suitable overall policy framework and the way that this problem has been dumped onto the lap of employers and the way that employers have responded, namely often allowing someone to go part-time, for example, and not replacing the hours of that part-time worker so that those hours get dumped onto the laps of already busy people. As I always say, that's not the fault of the mother. That is just simply bad management. That is poor management of a workplace flexibility initiative, and it's something I absolutely don't endorse.
Well, here are some emails that seem to endorse some of your positions. Robert in Burlingame says, I'm a father who left a great government job because they would not give me flex time to take care of my children. I said I would work part-time or with a cut in pay. My wife is a professional in the biotech industry, makes more money than I, and we would be financially hurt by her taking more time off. The role I was in was a blue-collar job, and I received many stereotypic comments by fellow workers that I was not a real man. I believe there's a strong class relationship to how people relate to this issue. I'm a college-educated, and I live in an affluent community because of my wife's income, and it's normal to see men take the lead role in with child care. It's normal for me to be a stay-at-home dad. Brian says, despite my wife wearing dressy work clothes when she drops off my son at preschool in the morning and me picking up my son at noon in jeans or workout clothes and 3 days' growth of beard, she is inevitably called when there is a problem. Even the school's perceptions need to change.
Can I just say that if you're in that situation, and many, many people are, I think a very polite call to the school is in order.
Well, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg could do it, then why not trickle down? Lee from Palo Alto says, actually, radical feminism contributed to the problem as a consequence of its unrelenting hostility, not just to males, but to masculinity itself, in everything from requiring males to wear bathing suits, euros, find laughably prudish, to defining men's roles in divorce as money provider, period. Our divorce laws and courts enforce this model pervasively while paying lip service to parental egalitarianism. And that has bled back into marriage itself, with male role models considered inappropriate for kids to the extent that they're masculine. Outside the Bay Area, of course.
I don't agree, but I think that's a whole nother show.
I think you're right. Carol in San Francisco writes, I assume your guest is familiar with Leslie Bennett's The Feminine Mistake, a major refutation of the opt-out trend. Bennett survived those stressful years with young children by working from home, an option open to more of us, and by reliance on a superb babysitter who became a close friend. If only we could add to this equation more engaged fathers. My stepson recently married. Most of the women in the wedding party were brilliant MBAs who had indeed opted out. The bride is a VP at Goldman Sachs who is considering leaving her career. The irony here is that her new husband is more than happy to be the primary caretaker of the young children. This is so complicated, writes Carol. And Sarur says, I think one consequence of the family-unfriendly laws is the epidemic of obesity, and we know that the health costs of obesity are in the hundreds of billions each year. When both parents of young children have to work full-time, cooking healthy home food becomes extremely difficult, and a child's food preferences are made at an early age and hence the love of junk food. Don't you agree?
I do think that particularly with less affluent people, obesity is tied to work-family conflict. I think the emailer is dead right about that.
Molly says, have you done a study of how many men are taking the 6 weeks of baby bonding the California offers? I haven't seen many men taking advantage of it and using the argument that they can't afford it.
There is a study underway. I don't think it's finished yet. Men are taking it less than they should be. That's for sure.
And here again is Mark, who says, why should those who choose not to have children subsidize those who choose to have children? I don't get paid leave to spend time with my dog, my bicycle, or my tennis racket. My choices. We can already provide a huge unpaid subsidy. How many of us have heard from a coworker, could you stay late and cover for me? I have to pick up my children.
Let me just say, I think that the focus has been on children, but I would say a couple things. First of all, for people who don't have children, who is going to be your doctor when you're 90? It's going to be somebody that I raised, one of my children. The other thing I think is very important is that although people don't, not everyone has children, everybody has family. And people who do not have children have responsibility to take care of elders, ill people. They have a lot of important responsibility. And I hear the anger when work has been dumped on their lap due to bad management. I hear that anger, and I think employers should hear that anger. But I think that everybody has care responsibilities and family care responsibilities, and those are something that are not limited to people with children.
Well, and the people without children also sometimes say, and why should we not? Why should we have to pay taxes for schools to subsidize schools, public schools? And, you know, the answer is you're contributing to your community, you're educating citizens for that community, and so forth.
And you're making sure there's a doctor to treat you when you're dying.
There you go. Here's Mary, who says, I'm a scientific researcher, and I'm often asked what it would take to keep women in academia. At present, 50% or more of the biological science graduate students are women, but many fewer are professors. I suggested that women be allowed to take a break of a few years to get through the early child-rearing years. The response I was often given that they would be out of date after a few years at home and not be able to slot back into doing productive research. My response was that we don't say that when MD-PhD students take a few years off from research to finish their clinical duties, and they really don't have time to keep up on the literature during those years any more than a mom at home does. It's a matter of perception, as your guest was saying at the beginning of the show.
And I would urge her and others to check out my website, Gender Bias Bingo, which talks about women in science.
Let me go to more calls here, and we'll go to Sarah in San Francisco. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I am a professional. I teach at a state-funded community college, and I'm pregnant for the first time, so this program is very relevant in my life.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I've been told that my place of work has opted out of state-funded disability, the kind of question that you might not ask until you're actually pregnant, and that they have an internal disability plan, which they sort of encourage those to be really physically disabled and not new moms. And so I'm just wondering, as I head into my human resources department to discuss this, if the guest has some advice about how I can approach this topic with human resources and what are my rights?
So is the issue whether or not you're entitled to take leave or whether or not you're entitled to be paid for leave?
Both.
It's a legal issue. I don't want to give legal advice over the radio.
No, you're a law professor.
But you do. Yeah, I'm smart enough to. I'm a lawyer, so I know enough not to do that. But you do have legal rights. You should definitely talk to a lawyer or an agency and get yourself apprised of them.
And good luck to you. Thank you for the call. Charles writes, it would be interesting to know what LGBT families with two parents of the same gender illuminate about these work-life choices.
I am fascinated by that topic. And in fact, there's very, very few studies. The one that I am aware of that's most relevant, in my opinion, showed that that gay male couples are 1% more likely to have one partner out of the labor force when they have kids, and that lesbian couples are 4 percentage points less likely to have one partner out of the labor force. In my view, that just shows how much of this is being driven by workplace demands rather than heterosexuality.
Anthony, join us. You're on.
Hi. I'm 30 years old, have 2 graduate degrees, and I'm at a bit of a career crossroads right now. And the one big thing my wife and I have been talking about is whether or not I should maybe change my career path based on the fact of work-life balance being so important to both of us. Are there certain industries or fields that are better for men as far as that's concerned?
Well, there are certainly industries and fields that are worse. But even in those that my best advice to you is to do what you love, which I think is important advice for any professional, and to be very conscious of choosing the career structure. So, for example, I just talk about the law, which is one area that I know well, or in business, another area I know well. Many people who really are passionate about what they do but find themselves in an environment where it's basically 60 hours a week or nothing, choose the or nothing and become consultants and found their own businesses so they can do what they love in a workplace context that fits with their family values.
Good luck, Anthony, and thank you. And here's Katrina, who puts on our website this comment. I completely agree that men need to be part of this discussion. When women are forced out of the workplace due to lack of flexibility, it puts more pressure on men to be the provider, to work long hours, etc. Everything gets out of whack. I've been really inspired by what is happening in Sweden. In a nutshell, men in Sweden were given economic incentives to take parental leave, and it had a profound ripple effect on society. Men got more involved with their kids. Women went back to work earlier. The gender wage gap started to close, and even the divorce rate went down. We'll go to another caller here, and we'll welcome a caller from Beaver Dam, Kentucky. Susan, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say one of the callers was talking about business and how business needs to adapt. And I'd like to say that I think that applies to customers, not just employees. I'm frustrated with how often my wonderful engaged husband can't take our son to change a diaper because there's no changing tables in the men's room.
That's a great, great point. That's a really good point. The other point I would make is that some businesses really have gotten very serious about this. Some law firms, some businesses, really, a lot of them talk a good talk, but don't necessarily walk the good walk. But there are b- both, there are employers who are deeply committed to this, who are committed to making work-life balance a possibility both for men and for women. And I would just say it takes some digging to find them, but they are out there.
Do you think in these, and thank you for the call, Susan, in these enlightened countries like Sweden, do they have in the men's restrooms, do they have changing tables too?
I would imagine so. Well, Sweden actually has a formal government policy of equal parenting. And the daddy days, which have been referred to, are a result of that. Those are days of parental leave where if the father doesn't use them, the family loses them. And that's actually the only way that any country has ever found to get fathers consistently taking parental leave.
It's still a big uphill battle in this country, though, just for social and cultural reasons. And that caller is a perfect example of it.
It's a big uphill battle, but I think as some of the men that we've heard of indicate, once people start to talk about this not as a woman's problem or as a zero-sum game between men and women, but to say to men, look, we know that you feel sometimes really constrained, really in a straitjacket, and that this is a direction we feel we can go together. I think we can make some progress on this issue.
Joan C. Williams' book is Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter, and it's published by Harvard University Press, and it's out and available, and it's a lot of research, a lot of prodigious research, and I commend you for that and for your appearance here today, which I think was very enlightening. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Oh, somebody wants to know what helicopter parenting is.
Helicopter parenting is trying to develop your child's every skill to the extent of having 7 after-school activities.
There we go. And sometimes even beyond 7 when they get to a certain age. We're here with you, as I said, Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And we remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling 415-553-3300. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I'll be back with you on tomorrow. We're going to talk with Jamie Court tomorrow, famed consumer advocate in the state of California. And I hope you will join us for that. Thank you for joining us today. To all of you, our listeners, we appreciate your being with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.